Here's what's happening. There are huge protests on the streets of Belgrade. Is it fair to ask if it's a Western orchestrated color revolution that's really taking place? Now, remember the gunman who opened fire in a concert hall in Moscow and killed, injured some like 700 people? They're now apparently admitting that they were working for Ukraine. Then there's the gift that keeps on giving. Ted Cruz, who sponsored and supported the war against Russia and Ukraine, says it was a horrible mistake, but he just doesn't want to talk about it. You know who does want to talk about it? Viktor Orban. He says this.
NATO has no business in Ukraine.
Why not?
Ukraine is not a member of NATO, neither Russia. And my job is to keep it as it is. Thank you very much.
My job is to keep it as it is. The guy's always saying something important and getting headlines all over the world. Maybe there's something to it. Get ready for the Sanchez effect. Let's do this. There's a saying in my country, the United States of America, you've probably heard of it. It goes something like this. If it walks like a duck and it quacks like a duck, it's probably a duck, right? Now, let's see what all the quacking is about. These are just some of the scenes that are coming in from Belgrade, Serbia. Tens of thousands of protesters are taking to the streets. Look at this. Because they're mad at their government. Now, their anger was sparked by a wall that collapsed and killed people at a rail station. Which, by the way, that sounds horrible. But it does kind of seem like an unlikely trigger point for demonstrations that look like this. So why am I and others asking questions about the legitimacy of these protests? Well, because NATO is not exactly a fan of Serbia and has a pretty rotten historic tendency of interference there. And there's no better example of that, by the way, than this. See those rockets taking off and landing? This is NATO bombing the hell out of Belgrade back in 1999. Remember, NATO bills itself as a peacekeeping organization that is non-aggressive. Let me tell you what it did, and then you could tell me if to you that sounds non-aggressive. Look at this. That's Belgrade getting bombed. Buildings where people lived. It bombed Belgrade, killed civilians. For 3 straight months, shelling night after night to bring about essentially what was a regime change in the area. Now, there's another reason to wonder whether these protests are actually inspired, influenced, or even orchestrated by the West. And that's the fact that it looks and smells like one of those so-called color revolutions that have taken place in the past in countries like Georgia, for example. Their agents working secretly in the country created the conditions for and actually managed the uprising against the governments to make sure that it was, in that case, anti-Russia, for example. By the way, you can argue the same damn thing happened in Ukraine. Here is a U.S. senator admitting to it on the air in this interview with Tucker Carlson, which has become this interview, at least what I call it, the gift that keeps on giving.
What failures, foreign policy failures, have I presided over?
Well, we were unable to beat Russia in the war that you supported against Russia. You've been spending the last 3 years telling us that Vladimir Putin is evil and we're going to beat him with other people's children, and a million of those kids are now dead. You've never apologized for that. That was a full failure.
By the way, look... The level of number of falsehoods you lay out just in one statement are rather stunning.
You haven't
stunning.
Supported the war against Russia?
Are rather stunning. So the war against Russia was caused, which I have explained in great detail, by Joe Biden's weakness.
But you supported the war.
If you want to talk, we can talk Russia and Ukraine. I'm happy to talk about it.
Do you think that's been a success?
No, it's been an absolute disaster.
Okay, but you supported it. Shouldn't you apologize?
No, you should apologize. I'm not going to engage in the demanding of apologies. So I'm going to.
My point is, all these failures, no one ever says I'm sorry.
Or do you just throw out like you? If you want to talk, we can talk.
Okay, I do. I want to know why That seems like a true disaster for the United States. You have supported it.
Do you believe Joe Biden's weakness caused the war in Ukraine?
I think Joe Biden's aggression caused it.
His aggression? What aggression?
He demanded that Ukraine join NATO. How does that help the United States?
It is a terrible idea, and I have vigorously opposed Ukraine joining NATO.
Okay, so that's what caused the war.
No, it's not.
Is this crazy or what? I mean, many U.S. senators, especially on the Republican side, and even some on the Democratic side of the aisle, now admit that what the U.S. did in Ukraine was wrong. And it's ended up making Ukraine weaker. Well, we spent, what, $300 billion or close to it? And it's also, by the way, most likely made Russia stronger. And there he is saying it. The war is still going on, and instead of trying to stop the war or at least acknowledge the mistake, the infamous Ted Cruz, he can't get himself to say, big mistake. We need to undo the mistake. He can't say that. But he says it's a horrible mistake. The whole thing was wrong. Isn't that crazy? It's like doublespeak. It's like circumlocution, you know? People talking in circles. One guy, though, who is getting credit throughout the global South, especially, and other places too, I guess, for telling it like it is. What's ironic is this guy's not from the global South or a global South country. Viktor Orban is the prime minister of Hungary, which is in NATO and the EU. He's kind of like the guy who's yelling inside of a building because he sees a fire, but nobody listening to him.
Do you expect that Russia will be mentioned as a threat or an adversary in a final statement after this summit?
It's always mentioned like that.
Do you support it?
I think Russia is not strong enough to represent a real threat to us. We are far stronger.
Are you happy that President Zelensky is being kept on the sidelines this time and there's no talk of Ukraine membership for NATO?
NATO has no business in Ukraine. Ukraine is not a member of NATO, neither Russia. And my job is to keep it as it is. Thank you very much.
Mic drop. You know, when it comes to Ukraine, whether you're on one side or the other of this horrible conflict, it's nice to see somebody like Orban with the courage to kind of call it like it is, even if it makes him go against the in crowd, you know, the cool guys in NATO and the EU. Well, here's a report that came out today that I want to share with you that says what most people around the world already knew, or at the very least, suspected. Do you remember this? This is one of the most horrible things that's happened in a long time in Moscow. Those are the scenes from the horrible attack on the Kirkus concert hall at a shopping mall in Moscow. The event was a sellout. People, mostly families and friends, packed into an auditorium. And that's when suddenly the gunmen began firing into the crowd. They also exploded firebombs to try and burn down the building, which, as you can see here, almost worked. And if that wasn't bad enough, they also used knives to slash at the people who were trying to escape from the fire. Isn't that crazy? I mean, right from the beginning, there were signs pointing to Ukraine with this thing, right? The gunmen, for example, were using Ukrainian telephones registered in Ukraine. The numbers that they were calling as they tried to escape were Ukrainian telephone numbers. So now, what seemed obvious also seems to be official. You know why? Because according to security officials, the suspects have confirmed that they were hired by a, quote, Ukrainian state entity and used Ukrainian-supplied weapons. That's what they're telling the folks who are interviewing them. Again, think about this. The attack was as violent an act of terrorism as one could imagine. So you would think that any new reporting on this, right, on this horrible, horrible, horrible thing about who's responsible for it would be extremely newsworthy, right? No. So here is what is most interesting about this, and somewhat frustrating. Hardly anyone in the Western news media is reporting about this. I mean, I checked. I checked on CNN. I checked on the BBC. I looked at the New York Times. They're not reporting this. Wouldn't you think they should? So what are they talking about? They're not talking about something where someone died. Instead, they're talking about words. This guy's words.
Death to the IDF! Death to the IDF! Hell yeah, from the river to the sea, Palestine must be, will be, inshallah, it will be free.
Isn't that crazy? That's like one of the biggest stories that we're seeing out of the West. And look, this is how they're treating it. Look at the stuff they're writing. The Telegraph, Reuters, Starmer comments, police investigating. All over Europe, people are asking for an investigation of that guy because he said those things, because of those words. Words where nobody died, but it has all of Europe with its hair on fire. It's kind of an interesting way of looking at things, isn't it? We're going to be right back with more on this. Stay right there. Let me just come out and say this as directly as I can. If you are not following the Gray Zone and you're not following Max Blumenthal, you're making a mistake. If you're somebody who likes to know about what's going on geopolitically, if you like to know and see some critical reporting on the state of perpetual wars, for example, and the lies that are often told in its pursuit, hardly anywhere in the world better to find information about this than Max Blumenthal. I'm not kidding. And you know what? Max is good enough to join us now to share some of his wisdom with us. Max, so good to see you.
Good to see you. It's been a while.
You've been doing such amazing work. I don't even know where to begin, but I think I want to begin with the story I saw you do last week, which I thought was so good, where you, at the very height of this conflict with Iran, the United States, and Israel, or however you want to describe that triad, you broke a story about how Mr. Trump is really being spoon-fed information, maybe not even legit information, by people inside his administration. Directly, you said, the director of the CIA and the director of CENTCOM, and that those two individuals are getting their information directly from Israel and then pumping it right into Mr. Trump. Wow, interesting story. Can you take us a little bit further into that, please?
Yeah, me and my close colleague, Anya Parampil, got this story from a Trump official, someone who has been very well aware of how the sausage is being made, the kosher sausage inside the Trump administration. And this, and our story was confirmed just yesterday by the Mossad director, David Barnea, who came out and congratulated CIA director John Ratcliffe for the key role that he played in assisting Israel in assuring that the U.S. would bomb Iran on behalf of Israel. What we reported, sourcing a Trump official, was that Ratcliffe was essentially acting as the Mossad stenographer, taking everything he heard in briefings from the Mossad and key Netanyahu aides like Ron Dermer, hysterical WMD deceptions claiming, for example, that Iran was going to hand over a nuclear warhead to the Yemeni Houthis within a week, and then he would go to Trump and tell Trump, we have to bomb Iran. They're going to have nuclear breakout capacity in days. We have to do this. And meanwhile, the chief of staff in the White House, Susie Wiles, was making sure that Donald Trump was isolated with figures like Ratcliffe, the Mossad stenographer, and CENTCOM chief Michael Kurilla, General Michael Kurilla, who has been just ferrying back and forth to and from Israel to meet with his counterparts there and absorbing their worldview. He's been referred to in the Telegraph as Israel's favorite general. And he would represent the military. Ratcliffe would represent the IC. And Trump was just absorbing basically Israeli disinformation about Iran's nuclear program. And it was all thanks to Susie Wiles, who would exclude the dissenters like Tulsi Gabbard from key meetings like the briefing at Camp David on June 8th. And we learned subsequent to our investigation that we published in the Washington Post that Susie Wiles actually literally worked for Benjamin Netanyahu. She went and basically was flown in 2020 as Netanyahu feared that he was going to lose and helped him kick off a kind of American-style Super Bowl extravaganza of rallies modeled after Trump's rallies. So the White House chief of staff literally was a Netanyahu employee, and then she's acting on behalf of Israel to isolate Trump among the Mossad stenographers. And then here's another element, Rick. I reported in April, off-the-record comments that I obtained from a private AIPAC meeting in Washington months before, where the new CEO of AIPAC, Elliot Brandt, was boasting about how he had cultivated John Ratcliffe ever since he was a freshman member of Congress, a backbencher from a small town in Texas, and that now if anything goes sideways in the Trump administration, he can get on the line with Ratcliffe and make sure that they have access. And who is they? I mean, it's AIPAC, but it's really Israeli intelligence. So what we're looking at is a kind of coup that took place, an Israeli coup of U.S. intelligence and the Trump administration to lead the U.S. into bombing Iran. And Trump is foolish enough to believe that this was a kind of one-off strike and that he's not going to be drawn in for more.
Oh, my goodness. The thing you just said about Susie Wiles, I'm floored. So the person closest to the United States, the person who decides who gets to be with him, who gets to talk to him, who gets to go into his office, used to work for Bibi Netanyahu and is now running the president of the United States' schedule and essentially life.
Yeah, I mean, imagine that. That the person who controls all access to Trump, everything he sees and hears, went in voluntarily to work for Netanyahu. She doesn't seem to think Israel's even a separate country. And no one's more upset about this than her predecessor, former chief of staff Steve Bannon, who was the intellectual architect of America First, who has accused Trump of basically betrayal with what he did by bombing Iran. So this is a, you know, anyone who understands what America First means is outraged by this entire scandal. But this was sort of a footnote, and it should have been a much bigger scandal that Susie Wiles and also another former key Trump aide, Corey Lewandowski, went and worked for Netanyahu. And we didn't even know that.
And these people are all Zionists, correct?
I assume they would say that they are, that they might be Christian Zionists.
Yeah, no, but it has nothing to do with religion being Zionist, as you well know, you're Jewish.
Well, what the Washington Post also reported was that Susie Wiles kept demanding more and more money, or there wasn't enough money coming in, so she eventually left the position from Netanyahu. I mean, these people are ultimately lobbyists.
Well, speaking of money, I'm wondering about Mr. Trump, and I know you can't read a man what's in a guy's head or heart, but I wonder if it's easier to convince a guy that has taken so much money from. So much casino money in the past that he already feels kind of indebted to want to do this, you know, little favor for Bibi Netanyahu and blow the hell out of Iran.
Yeah, I mean, look at Trump's performance on Ukraine. He was the first president to send offensive weaponry to the Ukrainian military, but he didn't want to. He was even impeached over his initial refusal to do so, but he always does it. He always gets rolled. He always winds up filling his administration with neocons after campaigning against them. He clearly didn't want to go to war with Iran, but ultimately he did it because the pressure points are just so myriad, from Susie Wiles to the Mossad and its briefers in the White House to what you mentioned, hundreds of millions of dollars from the Adelson family to Donald Trump, along with Zionist donors that most people haven't heard of, like Ike Perlmutter, or Bernard Marcus. There are so many of them. But Donald Trump has come out and openly said that no one visited him more in the White House than Sheldon and Miriam Adelson, and that had an effect. I think $150 million flowed into Trump's campaign from Miriam Adelson just this year, but there are hundreds of millions throughout his career. And this has a serious effect, a clear effect. I mean, Miriam Adelson has testified in Netanyahu's corruption trials because she was so close to Netanyahu. So the points of leverage on the Trump administration are enormous. And once Israel bombed Iran on June 13th, it was clear to me, it was inevitable that the U.S. would eventually have to follow. And what I think Trump thinks he did, because he doesn't want to get drawn into this very deeply, he actually wants a Nobel Prize and he wants everyone to love him. What he thinks is going to happen is that this will go away. But it's not going away because of the intelligence assessment that leaked from the Defense Intelligence Agency that Fordo was not destroyed. Mm. And we all knew it wasn't going to be able to be destroyed. And Iran even announced that it had moved the 60% enriched uranium stockpile days before the strike. So now Israel's demanding, you can see the pressure building for the U.S. to go back in. Trump getting asked, or would you go back in? And Israel announcing that this war is not even over yet. So Trump has unlocked a Pandora's box that I think threatens to destroy his legacy before it's even over.
Was that a Machiavellian play by Trump to start a war and then end it and take credit for stopping the thing that he started, do you think?
Absolutely. I mean, Trump thought it was a brilliant diplomatic Machiavellian masterstroke that he had given both sides the ability to claim victory and call it a day. Mm-hmm. Because I don't think he fully understands the Israelis. And that's what accounted for his tirade against Israel as he was on his way to NATO, leaving the White House, where he ranted against Israel for violating the ceasefire and said he had to make the planes do a U-turn because they were going to do a munitions dump over Tehran, which they actually did. Mm. And then he condemned both sides for not knowing what the F they're doing. That's Donald Trump raging because his Machiavellian master plan to be seen as the peacemaker was disrupted. What he doesn't understand is that Israel is operating under a very destabilizing logic. Like its system is fundamentally destabilizing, and it's in a race against time. Whereas time, while Iran may not have the technological or military advantage over Israel, they have time on their side, and all they have to do is continue enriching, rebuild their air defenses, get some, replenish their air force with Chinese hardware and platforms, whereas Israel has to keep wiping this out continuously. That's why Israel, we see them bombing Lebanon, violating the ceasefire 4,000 times with Hezbollah. They can't allow Hezbollah to rebuild. And now they're going to try to do the same thing, what they call the Lebanon option in Iran, which sets the stage for another intense conflict.
Mohammed Mirandi told me that he thought that Iran was kicking the hell out of Israel, especially some of the signs and videos that, and some reports that we saw that were coming out of Tel Aviv, and that they that may have been the actual reason why Bibi Netanyahu was actually crying uncle and may have even requested for Trump to come in and stop the fight. Do you give any credence to that?
Yeah, I do. Steve Bannon, former White House chief of staff, who's had met with Trump days before Trump bombed Iran, said that Israel demanded the ceasefire, that Trump rescued Israel. Hmm. Well, I think Israel did score some devastating or painful blows against Iran. I mean, they killed 29 senior IRGC officials. That's no small thing. They did a lot of damage against Iran's anti-aircraft systems. They were hitting Iranian ballistic missile launchers, forcing Iran to stage smaller kind of hit-and-run volleys. Hmm. But Iran, I think, won a political and psychological victory. They failed to establish deterrence, and Israel will likely come back for more. But the political blow and the psychological blow was enormous against a society that's essentially a settler colonial society that doesn't feel as connected to the land, where many of its citizens can actually just go to Europe. Hmm. There was a lot of economic damage that Israel suffered, unprecedented damage, and Iran managed to target Israel's knowledge economy, which is intimately connected to its death tech and military. We're talking about the Weizmann Institute, where Israel has refined its nuclear and drone programs, as well as doing advanced AI and gain-of-function research. It was completely destroyed, $570 million of damage, billions of damage to Israel's tech sector. The Microsoft offices in Beersheba were hit. For the first time, we saw Israel's Pentagon, Hakiria, get hit on its grounds. It wasn't a direct hit, but this shakes the psyche, the kind of colonial psyche of Israel. And I think if this war had continued, the political problems would have mounted for Netanyahu. One interesting development out of Israel is that you can see how the war benefits Netanyahu politically. Today, he was supposed to sit and be interrogated for hours in one of his corruption trials, but he convinced the Mossad director and the intelligence and military chiefs to waive off the interrogation because Netanyahu has to assess the damage of this war and prepare for more.
I watched the Bibi files last week. I thought it was pretty good. It made me think that in many ways, Bibi became more right-wing, more entrenched, and does many of the things that he does because he fears that if he doesn't do that, he will no longer be in power and he's going to go right back into that courtroom. That seemed to be the story I got from that. Have you seen it?
I have. And that's a really great point. I think that's the ultimate takeaway. Netanyahu would not be in power were it not for the most extreme messianic fascistic elements in Israeli society. The linchpin of his coalition is the Otzma Yehudit, or Jewish Power Party, which is a literally Jewish fascist party now represented by Finance Minister Bezalel Smotrich, who and before that you had Itamar Ben-Gvir, and they were just demanding that Netanyahu break every or prevent every ceasefire deal in Gaza from taking place and go in harder and harder on Gaza, kill more and more. Now they're demanding, and successfully, that the Israeli military begin to target everyone associated with the civilian infrastructure of Hamas, including like money changers. So they're just slaughtering civilians across Gaza to keep Netanyahu's coalition together. And then you have the ultra-Orthodox parties who want to keep their men out of the military. And that's the other thing holding his coalition together. So Netanyahu is always catering to his right, or watching his right flank. And Netanyahu, I think, is a misunderstood figure in the West. He did not want to get drawn into a long, open-ended conflict. He's always preferred shorter conflicts. And his ultimate objective was to get the U.S. to bomb Iran. So he managed to do that on the condition that he stay in Gaza. And I don't think he bargained for having a Democratic administration in Washington give him pretty much everything he wanted to make this moment possible. So this isn't all on Trump's shoulders. I still think this is largely Biden's fault, and that Biden bears the ultimate responsibility for keeping the most fascistic right-wing coalition together in Israel.
Well, yeah, I mean, your point is clear, and I'm not sure it was Biden, because I'm not sure he was totally awake during his administration. But boy, he had some people working in the State Department. I would watch those State Department briefings sometimes, Max, and I was wondering, do these people, are they Americans? Because they always sounded like they were just coming to the defense of Israel on everything, even when it was prima facie evidence that was put in front of them, like, look at these two dead children. I don't see any dead children. What are you talking about? What dead? I mean, it was really over the pale, beyond the pale in this case. Did you watch some? I mean, it was crazy.
Well, I was in the briefing room for a number of those briefings, and that's why I erupted at the final briefing of Tony Blinken, where the rest of the press was treating him like some normal figure and just asking him technical questions after he presided over what I consider to be the Holocaust of our time. And he could have ended it all with a phone call. There were ceasefire deals on the table in May of 2024 and even before, when Hamas said, we will release every hostage if Israel agrees not to invade. Blinken could have ended it quickly, but he was always obstructing it. And one of the things that I called out to him, because I would have never been called on, is, have you been compromised by Israel? Because Tony Blinken comes from a long line of Israel lobbyists. His grandfather was a key Israel lobbyist even before the establishment of the State of Israel, who presided over a study on the feasibility of settling the land of Palestine. And the man who raised him, his father-in-law, was Samuel Pissar, was one, the top Israel lobbyist in France, consigliere to Mitterrand, and also was the consigliere to Robert Maxwell, a Mossad agent who is the father of Ghislaine Maxwell. And this is what Tony Blinken comes from. And he says it openly in an AIPAC meeting in 2000. 7, Blinken said, I inherited my commitment to Israel's strength from my family, and no reporter has ever asked him about this. I don't understand why these aren't issues. The Secretary of State comes from Israel lobbyists. The White House chief of staff worked for Netanyahu. I mean, down the line, and the CIA director was cultivated by AIPAC ever since he came into Congress. All of these seem to be issues that the press refuses to talk about.
It makes you wonder, because our whole country is going through this America first, America first, America first movement. And there's this obvious giant frickin' elephant in the room that is saying Israel first, Israel first, Israel first, not America first. And I'm starting to sense, especially on the right and a little bit on the left, that people are getting it and it's making them angry, and that it started with Gaza and it's kind of continued with Iran. Is that your read too?
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, whether it's the election of Zoran Mamdani in the Democratic primary, making him the likely next mayor of New York, to the programming of Tucker Carlson and Steve Bannon on the right, and the comments of Marjorie Taylor Greene that AIPAC should be registered as a foreign agent. You can see anyone who's not controlled by the lobby and who hasn't been co-opted is outraged about what they're seeing. And it's just a concern for human life is what it comes down to. Israel has slaughtered hundreds of civilians in Gaza in the last 24 hours, some of the most intense attacks that we've seen. They just bombed an area in Gaza City that, it has been in ruins, but I used to work there with my wife, Anya Parampil, when we were there. And they were bombing journalists who were using it as an internet point to upload videos. And one journalist was killed and another one was badly wounded. This is what they've been doing day in and day out. And it just causing so much outrage. That's why you hear at Glastonbury chants for death to the IDF. And the establishment just doesn't get it. They don't understand how hated they are for going along with this. But it's going to start making waves in US politics, and their only answer is censorship, de-democratization, and the criminalization of grassroots groups like Palestine Action in the UK, which was just proscribed as a terrorist organization.
Or calling people anti-Semitic, which is just not working as well as it used to anymore, especially since half the people you're calling anti-Semitic are Jewish and demonstrating inside Israel and in the United States. It's like,
yeah, exactly.
It's like a Fellini movie. Like, wait, you're calling them anti-Semitic, but they're Jewish. It's like, well, it doesn't matter.
And then for like real Nazis or people who hate Jews, it's just a badge of honor to be called an anti-Semite now. It's like, hey, I'm a free speech warrior. All right. And that's the dynamic that Zionists created.
What do you make
of...
Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say they've cheapened the allegation to the point where it's a badge of honor.
Yeah. And you know what it's doing too? I mean, it's really hurting Jewish people around the world, where people I think are now going to, you know, somebody like you and so many others, you know, Americans who are Jewish or whatever the hell they happen to be. But, you know, people will now identify their religion with the actions of a country that's doing some really bad things, which is incongruent and shouldn't happen. But I fear that it's going to, you know?
By design. I mean, if you think about the logic of Zionism, the objective, as spelled out by Israel's first prime minister, David Ben-Gurion, in his memoirs, was an ingathering of all Jews in the world and construction of high population density, low-rise projects all across the Negev desert to accommodate them. But how do you get all the Jews in the world to move to this Spartan settler colonial consistently embattled apartheid state? It doesn't seem very appealing. Well, you have to make their lives miserable in the outside world. And the only way to do that is through anti-Semitism. So the more anti-Semitism that Israel triggers and inflames by identifying as the Jewish state while it's slaughtering children and shredding them to pieces on camera day after day, the better for Israel to justify itself as a sanctuary for all the world's Jews who suddenly become hated in their own communities and say they can't feel safe at the Glastonbury Festival because people are chanting death to the IDF. We'll move there. But the funny thing is, things have gotten so bad in Israel, which is due for another credit downgrade, that nobody is actually moving there. All the Zionist billionaires who are complaining about Zohran Mamdani being the next New York mayor are all planning to move to Boca Raton.
Next to my farm. Here's the deal, though. You just mentioned it. I was checking, and I think it's true. Israel is going through a net negative when it comes to immigration right now. People are not going to Israel. They don't want to live in Bibi Netanyahu's Israel. Isn't that, that is fascinating. Am I right?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, Israel's tech sector is the one thing that's really sustaining the upper middle class and preventing a brain drain. One of the largest divisions, or the largest division in the Israeli military, is Unit 8200. It's their spying cyber warfare division.
Yeah.
And to maintain in-country employment for all those highly educated youth, basically what's known as the Ashkenazi elite in Israel, there needs to be venture capitalists investing, providing capital for Israeli startup firms. And that is suffering now because of the damage that Israel suffered in this war. But because foreign direct investment depends on a stable environment, and for the first time they saw that Israel's anti-aircraft defenses failed and that Israel is in a battle against a near peer competitor. So foreign direct investment is down at record levels, and it already was before this war. It had plunged by like 60% since 2023. And I mentioned Israel's already undergone a credit downgrade. It's due for another. It costs $300 million just to sustain this war every day. And billions of dollars of damage in infrastructure has been wreaked by Iran's ballistic missiles. So there's a brain drain, another brain drain coming in Israel. And what this leaves to sustain the Jewish population in this demographic trench war against the Palestinians is the ultra-Orthodox who don't serve in the military and the settlers who demand so much from the state to pay for their lifestyle in the occupied West Bank. And that is not a very happy future for the so-called Jewish state.
I remember when I was spending some time in Israel, beautiful country, by the way, great food. But I was in a taxi and I was talking to the taxi driver, and we saw some Orthodox folks, and they were walking by, and he had a pejorative name for them. But then I asked him, why do you not like those folks? And he said, because they're lazy, they don't work, they steal our money, they're our tax. He just went on and on and on. And I thought, wow, so that's what they really think. There's a real dysfunction going on inside that society because of that, I think. I think that taxi driver was right. He wasn't alone.
Yeah, I mean, the father of the main opposition leader in Israel, Yair Lapid, his name was Tommy Lapid, he started a party. The whole party was just based on contempt and disdain and hatred of the ultra-Orthodox. And their main agenda was to get them to serve in the military. And so one of the biggest political crises, once this war ends in Gaza, will be on whether to force the ultra-Orthodox, the youth, to join the military. And the ultra-Orthodox parties are in open revolt. They have protests all the time that turn violent. And you can see scenes of secular looking Israelis beating ultra-Orthodox Jews. It looks like 1930s Germany. And the thing about the ultra-Orthodox, that's the paradox, is they believe in religious segregation. They want to be totally left alone in their communities where the men study Torah all day, do not work. The women work in like call centers, and they all depend on welfare from the state. Ugh. And then they don't give back to the most important thing to Israel, which is militarily occupying and dominating the Palestinians. But from the Palestinian point of view, the ultra-Orthodox pose very little threat. They're not attacking them. It's the secular and religious nationalists who pose the biggest threat because they believe in political segregation. So the political segregationists need to co-opt and dominate the religious segregationists in order for the state to continue, because the religious segregationists, ultra-Orthodox Jews, they produce like 10 kids per family. They're shooting them out like T-shirt guns. They're already 15% of the population, but they only 1% of them serve in the military.
Sounds like a line out of JFK, like a paradox or an enigma wrapped in a riddle. Wow. Hey, finally, you mentioned this rapper. He's in the news, and I was watching earlier, and CNN's going crazy with it, and the BBC's going crazy with it, and the New York Times and Le Monde, everybody's writing about this rapper, horrific guy, because he said something nasty about the IDF, which, by the way, you should never wish for anybody's death. It is offensive to wish for people's death. I get it. But, man, they're making it bigger than, you know, a war or an invasion or a battle. For example, I mentioned that investigators finally confirmed what we all knew, that Ukraine had something to do with the Crocus attack here in Moscow. And it hasn't even gotten a mention in Western newspapers. But they're talking about this. What does that say?
Well, this is very frightening to Western elites who think that culture can be used as an instrument for controlling, as like kind of an imperial soft power instrument. I mean, this is a BBC festival. The BBC is basically part of the UK Foreign Office. It's been used as a information weapon against Russia. When I was in Iran, you know, BBC Persia would show concerts in the UK, and, you know, they'd have, you know, gay pride flags, and this was something that they wanted to project into Iran. And now this concert has become a militant center for Palestinian solidarity. And they're calling not for the death of Jews or even Israelis, they're calling for the death of an institution which is at the center of an apartheid state. Essentially, they're calling for the same thing as the abolition of the South African Defense Forces that was the linchpin of South African apartheid. This is a, you know, it's a material demand, and it's very frightening to Western elites. This is the call of the cri de coeur, the call from the heart of a generation. And the singer was previously, the rapper was sort of previously unknown in the rest of the world. Now he's becoming an international hero. He goes by Bob Villain. Now consider, I mean, Bob Dylan was, after he abandoned his commitment to the civil rights struggle and became sort of a narcissist, he got into Kahanism, extremist Jewish nationalism. And he actually released a song in 1982, not a lot of people know this, called The Neighborhood Bully, defending Israel and accusing everyone who pointed the finger at of Israel of being kind of unfair. So, you know, you're going from Bob Dylan, who was still considered a hero despite his momentary support for Israel, to Bob Villain. That's where the Zoomers, the Generation Z, is. And it's frightening to an entire kind of Western so-called rules-based order that has propped up this apartheid state, and now the emperor has no clothes.
Max, before we finish, I want to ask you a little bit about you. I mean, you're just an amazing person. You're a courageous person. I mean, you could have been the most establishment person in the history of the United States if you wanted to. You went to the finest universities. You studied at almost specialty schools. Your father worked in the White House. You literally could have taken the path that said, this is a great system, I'm going to defend it, and I'm going to make a lot of money from it. And instead, you spend your time trying to point out what's wrong with the system, and you're as vehement about it as anybody out there, and also, by the way, as smart as anybody else out there. Why?
Well, not everyone thinks I'm the greatest person, but and I think my background there was a little overstated.
Well, I mean, I've looked at your credentials in terms of your education, and you know, you've been in the best and been surrounded by some of the best institutions that our country has to offer.
Well, I mean, just to put it simply, I was, you know, my father's a scholar and a journalist, and there are people in my family like that, and I was raised to question everything, and that's what I've always done. And I think that, you know, represents a tradition in Judaism that I'm trying to carry forward in the face of Zionism. And the more you ask questions, the more the conventional wisdom falls away in your hands. And journalism has provided me with an opportunity and an avenue for going out and seeking answers, going out across borders, across walls, into places where many Americans couldn't otherwise go. And I've learned some very interesting and compelling things. And what I think a journalist's job is, particularly in the West, is to tell people here what they're not supposed to know. Hmm. And that's what we're trying to do every day at the Gray Zone.
Tell people what they're not supposed to know. So well said. Well, you're a courageous guy and you do good work, and I'm glad you're doing it. And I said it at the beginning and I'll say it again. If you're not subscribed and if you're not checking out the Gray Zone, you should be. You're missing out. It's that good. Max Blumenthal, as usual. Thank you, my friend. Good to see you again. We hadn't talked in a while.
Thanks a lot, Rick. It's been too long. Good seeing you.
Appreciate it. And that's our news. But I want to thank you for being with us and remembering to follow us on a podcast that we have called Journalistically Speaking. That's my podcast, and you can see me there from time to time, bringing you interviews like this one with Max. And if you want to chat, I'm on X or Twitter, whatever we call it these days, at Rick Sanchez TV. And I'll be looking for you there and here. See you next time.